Yeah, my name is Sharjah Bristol Palmer and I'm currently in my first year of my PhD at the University of Birmingham. I'm currently doing my research on the impact of hypermasculinity on HIV/AIDS related stigma discrimination in the Caribbean. The titles are a little bit different than what I actually submitted. The differences I submitted in the Caribbean community because I was going to do it on the Caribbean community in the UK. After a bit of research and talking to people, I found that a lot of their responses, approaches and behaviours were actually coming from back home in the Caribbean, so I just thought it would be a nice chance to go on holiday. And also just to go straight to the core influences of that population, so now that's why I've changed it to the Caribbean. So my research is going to focus on mainly two topics. It's to construct and understand the idea of masculinity in the Caribbean and actually identify how it's different to other types of masculinities. That's one thing that I have to work on. And then the other thing is also to look at stigma and discrimination in regards to HIV-related AIDS in the Caribbean and look at what's also different in that region in regards to stigma than to other countries. The purpose of my research is to bring those two concepts together and understand and give a better perspective on how HIV-related stigma reduction programs and strategies can be better implemented when you can understand masculinity and then understand why the discrimination is there. So that's what I'm going to talk about a little bit today. There is a lot in this field, so I'm going to try and condense it as best as I can, but still enable you to understand it. Okay, so the first thing I'm going to look at is masculinity and just the basic question of what is it? What is masculinity and what is a man? So I just want you to kind of keep that question in your mind. What is a man? When we think about a man, these are general agreements, general acceptances. You think of a strong, well-built man who can kind of provide for their family, protect economically, provide as well. What you don't think of in regards to a man is a weak man. Someone who's weak is not a man. Someone who has kind of feminine characteristics is not a man in regards to the general term of what society understands a man to be. Michael Kimmel actually spoke about when we talk about masculinity, we look at what a man is not rather than what a man actually is. We've got a quote from him here that says that masculinity is, as well as femininity is, refer to the social roles, behaviours and meanings prescribed for men and women in any given society at any given time. So masculinities and femininities fall into the gender sphere, the gender understandings, the gender roles that we all come to kind of get involved in and society lives by, and some people choose not to, but generally speaking everyone slips into the role that society says that they should be living by. Where the problem comes is that kind of understanding, or the understanding we have of masculinity, is actually based on a Eurocentric ideal of a man, a more westernized conception of what a man should be. And what happens is that you end up with a quote at the bottom from Goffman, which talks about how there is only one complete unblushing male in America, a young, married, white, urban, northern, heterosexual, Protestant, father, of college education, fully employed, of good complexion, weight and height, and a recent record in sports. What Goffman says is that any man that doesn't fit into that category, at some point in their lives, they're going to feel less of a man in regards to the global, the universal understanding of what a man is. So anyone who is non-heteronormative, so who doesn't fit into the idea of a westernised criteria of manhood, so basically the other are not accepted, discriminated against, and in some places actually ostracized. In the case of masculinity, there has been an increase in masculine discourse over the last probably 30, 40 years. But once again, it's coming from a single standpoint of Western criteria and Eurocentric ideas. This brings me on to the focus of my research, which is Caribbean masculinity. And there are a lot of historical implications of the influences and what's left behind of colonialism. So men during colonialism were basically stripped of their manhood, were treated as inferior beings, were subjected to having to watch their wives being raped, and then also being raped themselves in front of their wives. What happened during colonialism is that, I'm not going to read out the statement, it's quite long, but I'm going to summarise what that says on there. What happened during colonialism is that men, black Caribbean men, were often used as studs, like as in the horse studs, so they'd find the biggest and the strongest men to basically breed and create more little slave children, meaning that that man couldn't stay still with a single woman because he needed to keep moving on. So that's where you get the kind of the absent father stereotype in the Black Caribbean community. What that also did is when the men were moving around and had to move on, it created independence in the female having to now grow up these children or child on herself, but also dependence on that female, dependence on the white slave masters to provide clothes, food, and so on and so forth. This little statement here is actually taken from a speech by somebody, a slave master called William Lynch. It's very controversial, this statement, I'll tell you what in a minute. And basically what William Lynch in the statement saying, you know, you take two black men and two black women, make them breed to create little black slave children, get rid of the men and make the women grow the children up to basically respect the slave master, and you would grow the women up to be independent and respect the slave master, but you'd grow the little male child to be quite weak and feminine because he's being grown by the woman. That's what it says in the statement. And if you followed that kind of principle, then you'd be able to keep your slaves for the next 500 years. This is controversial. A lot of people say that some of the wording, it's a very long document, some of the wording in the document didn't exist at the time that this was even put together. And then it's just very controversial. But what we can kind of agree on is that obviously slavery did happen, and the implications of slavery is what's happened there in regards to rape and so on and so forth. The reason why I'm talking about this is because this helps to build an understanding and a construction of the type of masculinities now left in the Caribbean. So where the masculinities kind of brought over to the Caribbean were from an African, West African understanding, then you had the mix of the Western colonial rules, their masculinities. So you've got a mixture now of a Caribbean masculinity that doesn't actually identify with either the African starting point, the foundation, or the slave master's idea of masculinity too. So they're trying to kind of find their masculinity. The problem that also comes into construction masculinity is in regards to the marginalisation of Caribbean men at the moment. So there's an argument by Miller on marginalisation. He talks about how currently black Caribbean boys are falling behind in education and so on and so forth. Predominantly, globally, boys actually receive a better education than women, and some of women, the inequality in regards to education for women, especially like primary secondary education. In the Caribbean, it's the other side around. It's the boys that are actually struggling. The girls are just surpassing the males to the point where, I think it's 2012, In the University of the West Indies in Monmouth, Kingston, there was an intake of 68% females to males in the university. There is a counter argument to the marginalisation of boys in regards to Chivani, who talks about, well, actually, yeah, you can argue that there's a marginalisation with Caribbean boys. However, when it comes to the top end jobs, the bankers, the solicitors, the lawyers, it's still men occupying those seats in regards to Caribbean society. So, what's happened in the domestic and the public arena is that many scholars argue that the current crisis with Caribbean masculinity is women, is to do with femininity, and the fact that the feminist movement is like doing so well globally. Let me change that. The feminist movement is doing so well in West countries and some developing countries, that it's actually pushed certain categories or certain sections of men. So women now, especially in the Caribbean, are educated, they're able to work, they are independent. A lot of them statistically are single parents, but they actually don't need a man to help them in regards to their survival and bringing up their upbringing. When I read about that, it kind of brought me to something kind of personal growing up from a Caribbean background. And I remember my mom always saying to me and my two sisters, don't have a baby unless you can bring it up yourself. Don't have a child unless you can look after that child yourself. So while doing my research, I went back to my mom and says, Mom, why did you say that to me? And she says, because that's what my mom told me. And I thought, oh, okay. And I bet that's what my grandma's mom told her. And it was, don't have a baby unless you can look after it yourself. It wasn't, don't have a child until you're married, or don't have a child until you're in love. It was, don't have a baby unless you can bring it up yourself. So that mentality, the mentality that kind of started off from there, without even knowing it, it's kind of seeped still into generations present and alive today. Okay, what I'm gonna do now is bring you to back to the question. What I said is, what is a man? A man is everything that a woman is not. What is a woman? Everything. So what does that leave a man to be? Nothing. Okay? Right, so we're gonna move on to HIV and AIDS. I'm just gonna give you a global understanding of HIV at the moment. The latest figures that we've got is 2013. They're always like a year and a bit behind. So globally, there is approximately 35 million people worldwide living with HIV and AIDS. Of those 35 million people, approximately 19 million of them don't know that they have the virus due to just not getting tested or not showing symptoms yet. In the Caribbean, there are 250,000 people living with HIV, which gives the Caribbean a 1% HIV adult prevalence rate. Prevalence rate just means the percentage of the population living with the virus. If I compare that to sub-Saharan Africa, which globally everybody knows Africa's got an extreme crisis when it comes to HIV, there are 25 million people in Africa living with HIV. That's 70% of the population. Sub-Saharan Africa, 70% of sub-Saharan Africa are living with HIV and AIDS. Yes, in comparison to the Caribbean, that is extraordinary, but what a lot of people don't realise is that the Caribbean has the second highest prevalence rate after sub-Saharan Africa. A lot of people sometimes think it might be Asia or even South America. It's the Caribbean has the second highest prevalence rate of HIV globally. Countries that are increasing and showing a major problem because they've got 1.5% prevalence rate is Jamaica, Haiti, Barbados, Trinidad and Tobago. So the Caribbean as a region are trying to implement reduction strategies, testing campaigns, so on and so forth, to try and bring that prevalence rate right down. Okay, so these are this is a table taken from a report done by UNAIDS on Jamaica's current state of HIV. So these are the amount of people that were diagnosed in 2012 What I want to kind of draw your attention to is the maybe the stereotypes or preconceptions that a lot of people have and would think that sex workers would maybe have a high percentage rate or the clients using sex workers. Well, actually, in the Caribbean and in Jamaica, it's men who sleep with men, homosexual women who have the highest rates of HIV. This causes a major problem because in many Caribbean countries and in Jamaica in particular, they have something called the buggery law, which basically prohibits any type of anal sex between men and a man, or a man and a woman, or a man and any other type of creature. That law is still in place. It was put in place in 1861 during colonialism and imperialistic rule, and it has never been moved. So when you have a section of the population who have, according to tables and reports and statistics, have a direct association with a condition, a virus, HIV, and that section of the population actually take part, according to that country's law, in criminal activity, the acceptance and the stigma and the discrimination heading towards that section of the population is going to be quite negative, and it is quite negative to the point where in the Caribbean, across all islands, those men who sleep with men, especially men who sleep with men with HIV, can get killed, beaten up, can get ostracized. They actually seek refuge in the UK and other westernized and more accepting countries. So HIV AIDS related stigma and discrimination is an extremely negative and detrimental thing that's happening in Caribbean at the moment. The reason why people stigmatize in that region is mainly due to fear, and it's due to the fear of the association with homosexuality. They don't want anything that's kind of connected to homosexuality, because according to their law, what they've been taught and what's black and white in paper, men who sleep with men are wrong, which is interesting because, you know, there is homosexual men in the Caribbean. However, those men are treated very badly and cannot openly and securely come out and be comfortable with that. I've got here about contagion and the magic law of contagion, and I put that on there because when I read it, I just thought, oh my word. So that's just about, if you take yourself back to primary school and in the playground, and nobody didn't want to play with that person because apparently they smelled or they've got cooties or something like that. That's exactly what's happening at the moment. Nobody doesn't want to talk to that person who has HIV because apparently you're going to get it, or you're going to, you know, you can catch it. So it's the education's missing about transmission and so on and so forth, and how HIV is actually contracted in that region. And so what happens is when the region is trying to put together stigma reduction strategies, and they have made a really good effort in regards to media campaigns. They talk to faith-based organisations about, you know, not always drawing it down people's throat about 2.4 children and a man and a woman should be X, Y, and Z. Education, they're going to schools and trying to educate young people about it. They're even targeted and looking at the attitudes of the people living with HIV and AIDS and saying, why do you actually accept this stigma, and why don't you stand up for yourself? But what my research aims to kind of highlight and identify is that when you have a condition, a virus, HIV, so heavily associated with a group in a population that actually is a group practicing criminal activities, how do you get the rest of the population to accept that group? So if you've been taught from a young age, and it's embedded in society, that a man should be a certain way, how do you expect society, or how do you get those men to then accept the men, the other, the men who are not men according to their laws and doctrines and principles? How do you get those masculine Caribbean men to accept the other type of men and the conditions associated with those type of men?